track session number 27344, Reel 10.
Yes, well, there we were safely on board, so the lift went back up again. Now, from experience, they found that the time from an aircraft landing on until the lift was back up again was two and a half minutes. So the interval between aircraft landing on was 2.5 minutes. And we were training and practicing to get this down as neat as we possibly could. So almost invariably, when you were coming in to land on, with the batsman saying, OK, come on, you're OK, keep it coming. And you were coming in to land on, and there was a bloody great hole in the flight deck up in front of you. And the idea was that as you caught a wire, the lift would come up, clunk into position. And I tell you, sometimes it was just a bit frightening. But anyway, we didn't have anyone fly into the lift, so it seemed to work satisfactorily. But as I say, 2.5 minutes between aircraft is a long time when you're landing on 18 Barracudas and some fighters. And it really meant that the ship was not fit for operations in circumstances where there were submarines or enemy aircraft which could attack. But she did very well on the Murmansk convoys, because there weren't many German bombers that were going to come out from North Cape, although there were German reconnaissance aircraft. The reconnaissance aircraft were more giving information to submarines than they were to aircraft. So that's why the Murmansk convoys were so dangerous, really, from a submarine point of view.
And on board the Furious, were you accommodated aboard the Furious when you were at Scapa?
No. In Scapa, we were flown ashore to Hatstone each time. Now, at that time, there was no refuelling at sea. So the Furious could only stay at sea for 9 days. So it was 4.5 days up the Norwegian coast and 4.5 days back. And that was the maximum time that the Furious could spend escorting a convoy, and that would get them perhaps as far as North Cape, but no further. So the convoy still had a long way to go around to Murmansk without the Furious. So they did have some of the MAC ships, the merchant aircraft carriers, ships like the Vindex and one or two like that, and they could stay at sea longer, and they would go as far as they could round towards Murmansk. But again, you see, they were flying Swordfish and perhaps Martlets, the American fighters, and not very many of them. They didn't carry more than, I think, 4 Swordfish and 4 Martlets, because they all had to be parked on deck. So it wasn't very satisfactory, and the poor merchant navy had a hell of a time of it once the aircraft cover was taken away. Anyway, back to Furious. We used to fly ashore to Hatston every time Furious went back into Scapa. And we knew we'd be there for the length of time it would take Furious to reload with bombs and fuel, and then we knew we'd be back on board again. But what was I going to say about it?
The accommodation we're talking about.
The accommodation in Furious really was awful. The accommodation for junior officers was a big dormitory, really, I suppose, with bunks and lockers. And the lockers weren't very big, and the bunks were fairly close together, and the whole enclosed space didn't have very good ventilation. And the smell in that place was absolutely bloody appalling. You just about choked when you first went into it. But I suppose, having got in there and began to breathe again, you got used to it. But it really was terrible, simply because the ship's ventilation system wasn't designed to cope with the number of people that were now in the ship. And you see, with the number of Barracudas that we had, with three aircrew in each Barracuda, and then all the ship's officers, and, you know, it was really jam-packed with people. Never mind, we survived it. I don't know what the ratings were like, but they must have been packed like bloody sardines.
What facilities did you have for washing?
Oh, communal washing facilities, and you're queuing up to get to a basin or queuing up to get into a shower. Very, not primitive so much as not enough of them. It really wasn't a very hygienic arrangement at all.
What about messing? Would you mess in the dormitory area?
No. The wardroom, it was actually quite good. The wardroom is the dining area, and the wardroom anteroom is the lounge, as it were. Again, not really designed for the number of officers and aircrew that they had on board. And at that time, there's no doubt that an awful lot of people used to smoke. I suppose two-thirds of the men would smoke. Now, in the wardroom, with a fairly low ceiling, certainly lower than a normal living room, because most of us, medium height people, could reach up and touch the ceiling above you. So with all these people smoking, you would get smoke gradually getting lower and lower and lower until your feet were in fresh air and your head was in constant smoke. It really was terrible. And I used to find my eyes watering all the time I was in there, because an awful lot of people had the bad habit of throwing their cigarette ends, still lit, into the huge ashtrays we had, which were modified shells from big guns. And they would just throw their dog ends in there, and there they were left to smoulder, with this acrid smoke coming out to join all the rest. It really was absolutely terrible.
Was there any opportunity to get fresh air on board?
Well, it was the quarter deck, which was the officers' area, as it were. And it was fine. You could go out there, but I don't know. We didn't seem to use it very much in the Northern Atlantic. And you could always, if there was no flying going on, you would always exercise on the flight deck. But it was always encumbered with aircraft, because they couldn't carry all the aircraft in the hangars, and there would always be maintenance work going on or something going on the flight deck, so you didn't want to be in the road there. We did sometimes play deck hockey, and of course that was a major exercise as far as the ship's crew was concerned, because they had to clear away the arrestor wires and the air maintenance ratings had to clear the aircraft forward and aft out of the way so we could have a deck hockey pitch in the middle of the flight deck. But it was good fun. We used to have deck hockey competitions between the squadrons and between the ship's officers and the squadron officers and between the squadrons and the ship's ratings and that sort of thing. Quite often quite vicious.
Was it an opportunity for the ratings to take on the officers?
Absolutely. So, of course, we were defending ourselves as well. But it was just a rope, a ring of rope as a puck, and sticks that looked like walking sticks. And we just rushed at each other with these. But it was good fun. We thoroughly enjoyed it.
And can I ask about the aircraft storage? Because, obviously, as you said, you've explained what the lift looked like. Was there much of a facility to store aircraft below decks, though?
In the Furious, there were two hangars. One, if you imagine a cruiser with a big box put in the middle of it, the bow was still projecting forward from underneath the flight deck. And there was a hangar at that level, and it would have been possible for aircraft to have flown out of the hangar over the bow and away, if there had been enough wind and if they'd had the right aircraft and if they'd had the space. But it was a hangar which was half the length of the box. In fact, the Furious was frequently referred to as the box. And below that, there was another hangar which was full length. So there were two levels for the lift. I can't remember, I think the fighters used the upper hangar and the Barracuda's the lower hangar was the normal procedure. But getting the aircraft into the hangar, what a caper. They they could get the aircraft in by putting a steering arm in the tail wheel, and the hangar control people would push and steer the aircraft into position, sometimes manoeuvring it backwards and forwards two or three times to get it really into a tight corner. But when you came to the last three aircraft coming in, because there were three abreast, you didn't have space for manoeuvring, but you really had to use those spaces. So what they had was a railway across the deck, and the wagons of the railway were two flat trolleys which were positioned so that when the aircraft was pushed off the lift, the main wheels would land up on these two flat trolleys, and then the tail wheel would be turned 90 degrees and the whole aircraft would be pushed bodily sideways to get out of the way and get tucked in as close as it could to the side. The second last aircraft was pushed off to the other side, and the last aircraft came into the middle, and that was the hangar full. And it was full. You really had difficulty walking through a hangar filled with aircraft. And that was the condition, or those were the conditions under which the maintenance people were working, and sometimes doing quite major jobs on aircraft. And I often think that other people doing aircraft maintenance elsewhere would be aghast at the conditions that they had to work under. But they were very good. They kept our aircraft serviceable for all the exercises we were required to do. And let's face it, we did have accidents. We'd damage an undercarriage or a wingtip or something like that, and they would still manage to do it under these awkward circumstances. If they had to spread the wings to do some work, they would have to take the aircraft up onto the flight deck, spread it up there, do the work, and then strike it down again.
Where would the aircraft be armed?
In the hangar. I tell you, I can remember in one of the ships, I think it was HMS Indefatigable. Yes, it was at the time of Tirpitz. And the aircraft were being armed. And in the hangar above the wardroom, there were American fighters. And there was an occasion when some idiot managed to fire a machine gun in the wing of one of the American fighters. And when they're folded, the wings are folded back and the guns are pointing down into the deck. So this gun fired, I don't know, maybe four or five bullets down into the deck, very close above the wardroom. And we all nearly took off. God, what a fright. So accidents did happen. But the loading of bombs and torpedoes was always done on the flight deck because the wings had to be spread to do it.
You also mentioned that the aircraft would be on. There would always be a certain proportion of aircraft on the flight deck. Anyway.
Oh yes.
How were they secured in bad weather?
All over the flight deck, there were ring bolts welded into the deck in little sockets, the shape of the ring, so they lay flush. And these would be, I suppose, about every 6 feet square. 6 feet, 4.5, 6 feet abreast. So when the aircraft was put into position, there would be ring bolts close at hand so that you could take a wire strop, fix it to the ring bolt, and fix it to a securing point in the aircraft. And the strong points in the aircraft were built specially for these. And generally speaking, you would have two wires to each wingtip and two wires to each tail. And that would secure it for normal weather conditions. But if you were going into rough weather, they would double up as best they could. And you would find wires going in very odd directions, just trying to make sure that they would stay down. The flying surfaces such as the elevator, rudder and ailerons would be held in position by clamps. There were specially designed clamps which would hold them and prevent them banging about, because obviously the ship wasn't always steaming into wind, so the aircraft weren't always facing into wind, and if the wind came from astern, it could have damaged the flying controls quite easily by bashing them backwards and forwards. So, yes, there would be a number of aircraft parked on the flight deck, maybe 6 or 7. But there was always aircraft up there for maintenance anyway. Because, as I say, for the bigger jobs, and if they had to spread the main planes, they had to be up there. So the ratings used to working in really quite bad weather, and in particular the ratings who were working on the Mack ships on the North Atlantic, I don't know how they did it. They really were working in the foulest conditions. It's so cold sometimes that if you touched the tool with your bare hand, it would stick to it and that sort of thing. So they were doing engine maintenance with gloves. And it really seems to me to be amazing that they did it so well.
Can I ask you a little bit about the squadron, its organisation and its history, a little bit about...
Well, I was in 827 Squadron, which has always had been torpedo bomber reconnaissance, which means that for some years it had been albacores and swordfish. I don't really know when it was formed. Again, I was young and brash and not sufficiently interested to find out the facts about things that had gone on before. There were 18 aircraft in the squadron and, of course, 18 crews. The senior officer was a lieutenant commander. The next senior pilot would have been a lieutenant, and the senior observer would be a lieutenant. And if I remember rightly, when I joined, our CO was an old man of 23. And the average age of the air crew was 20. And we were all very young, very inexperienced, very brash. I don't know how we actually survived, but we did. The squadron was, generally speaking, divided up into a number of groups. The ratings who looked after armaments would be one group. The ratings who did the wireless radios would be another. Those who looked after the engines would be a third group. Those who looked after the airframes would be a fourth group. And each of these would have a divisional officer appointed, and that was one of us, one of the air crew. And it was our job to look after their well-being and make sure that their documents were kept up to date and that they got opportunities for promotion at the right time. And if they were on a charge, the divisional officer represented them when they went to see the commander or the captain. And he was generally supposed to look after them and their welfare as best he could. It did give us the opportunity. Yes. Well, anyway, the divisional officers are looking after the welfare of the ratings, and it did give you an opportunity to get to know them, because otherwise you would get to know only the two aircraft that worked regularly on your... the airmen that worked only on your aircraft. That would be an engine fitter and an airframe rigger. I mean, the armaments people and the radio people would come and go as required, but you didn't get to know them in the same way. But you were dependent for your life on these two doing their job properly. So you did get to know them, and we became quite friends, usually. But then again, the naval tradition is such that you wouldn't really meet them ashore or spend time with them ashore. But you could be as friendly as it was possible between the ranks on board. And it did work.
How did you get along with your telegraphist air gunners? Because were they all non-commissioned as well?
Yes, they were. And very friendly. My own particular air gunner, Everett, a nice chap. He was, I think, a bit more religious than I was. At least he was conscious of his religion and I wasn't. He must have spent a lot of time praying in the back. But to give you an example of the sort of thing that happened, I was sent from Hatston down to Donibristle, which is a naval air station close to the Forth Bridge. And I was carrying something, I don't know what it was, and I had to deliver it to Donibristle and come back again. The weather wasn't very good on the way down, and on the way back, it was terrible. I mean, the cloud base must have been perhaps 500 feet, but no higher than that, maybe 400 feet. And we set off from Donibristle, and I couldn't just go off into cloud because there's no way I was going to get down at the far end because we didn't have ground control. So it was a matter of navigating, seeing the ground all the way. So I went round the coast and flew around the east coast of Scotland, even turning into the Firth of Tay up to Dundee Bridge and back out that way because the visibility was so low you couldn't see across the Firth of Tay. Then round and up past Aberdeen and round past Rattray and then along the Murray coast until I got to very nearly Inverness and then across and up the Caithness coast. Got across and went along the north coast of Scotland until I reckoned I was more or less opposite the Orkneys. Now, I knew none of the Orkneys were very high, so I thought, well, we'll try this. So I set off, and luckily, I saw the coastline before it saw me, and I was able to turn and into a cove, and the next thing I knew, I was over the centre of Scapa Flow. All these, well, not all the ships, but many of the ships in Scapa Flow were flying barrage balloons. So there I was, in the middle of all these bloody barrage balloons. So I thought, how do I get out of this? So I decided the best bet was for me to fly as close as possible, but not over, any ship or thing that I saw ahead of me. So that if a barrage balloon was anchored to it, I was going past the side rather than trying to get through it. But again, you see, any aircraft flying over Scapa Flow was liable to be fired at. But I suppose I was very lucky in so much as the weather was so bad that they'd stood down all their guns crews. They weren't expecting anyone to come over. So I got through Scapa Flow and across to the far side and into Hatston and landed. And he was so relieved to get out, the air gunner. He really was. I saw him 50 years later. And when he was telling my wife about this particular episode, the poor guy was in tears about it. He thought I'd saved his life, whereas I bloody nearly killed him. oh, dear. He was a nice chap. Very, very nice. But again, unfortunately, we were just discouraged from seeing them ashore.
But during operations, obviously, there was a good relationship between crews.
Oh, yeah. We were very lucky. I had an observer who was older than me by, must have been 18 months. He was certainly older, quieter, more mature. And he said, well, apart from navigating you around the seas, I think my job is to sort of encourage you during the attacks. Which he used to do. But navigating over the seas with the Observer was a thing I really ought to have mentioned earlier. One of the most important things was to find out the wind strength. The Met officer in the ship would give you an idea of the wind strength so that you could plot your course to wherever you were going. But very early after you got off, particularly when you were going off as an individual aircraft, you would have to find the wind. Now, this was an exercise in skillful flying. What happened was that you would fly into wind as far as you knew. You could tell it by the waves. So you would fly into wind, and the observer would drop a smoke float. And at the second the smoke float hit the sea, he would tell you to go into a rate one turn. Now, a rate one turn is a specific speed of turn, so that you turn through 180 degrees in 1 minute. So you go around your 180 degrees, level up on the 180 degree course, the reciprocal, and fly on that for 2 minutes, exactly. Then you do another rate one turn to the left and come back. If there was no wind, you would come back exactly over the smoke float. But if you're not over the smoke float, as you never were, the observer at the end of the minute turn would take a bearing and distance on the smoke float. If the distance was difficult to assess, he would take two bearings at fixed interval. So then he would have two lines crossing, and he could see how far the smoke float was. So once he knew the distance that we'd finished up on after the turns, he could calculate how much the wind had blown us off. And he would say, right, the wind is from so-and-so at such and such a speed. So he would then recalculate the course to the target. And that was a very important exercise, and we had to practice it quite a lot so that both he and I were working together to get this wind speed correct. Because if it wasn't correct, the same thing could have happened as happened on my first exercise. You come back and there's no ship there. So that was one of the things, and Bob and I got on extremely well.
What did he use to take the bearings?
He had two compasses, very similar to a ship's compass, in so much as you can look through a sight and get a bearing on whatever you're looking at. And these two compasses were fixed in the bay windows, so that even if the smoke float finished up dead astern or dead ahead, he could still, by getting his head right out into the bay window, get a good reading. And it worked very well.
And you said he said that he would like to encourage you during the attacks. How did that, what form did that take?
Oh, I don't know, just talking to me and just making sure that I was not panicking. But we did get on well together.
Was it important to function as a tightly knit team?
Oh, always. I think it really was absolutely essential that you were working together, particularly when you were off on your own on an anti-submarine patrol or something like that. Talking together and being friendly together was all part of it, because you'd be airborne perhaps for up to 3 hours, and the pilot was strapped in his seat and wasn't moving anywhere. The observer and the air gunner could move around a little bit, but not very much. But it was just a matter of encouraging each other and talking to each other, getting through the boring parts. And talking about boring parts, making sure the pilot stayed awake. Because the Barracuda didn't have an automatic pilot. And if the aircraft started to drift off course or lose height or something like that, he would very quickly start to talk. Didn't matter what he was talking about. Even if it was the seabirds flying past, just to make sure that the pilot was going to answer. Because there's no doubt that, like driving on a motorway, you could get, with this very monotonous drone of the engine, you could, in fact, close your eyes too easily. So they used to give us tins of glucose sweets to take with us, so that we could suck these and give us just a little bit of energy and hope to keep us awake. And in fact, I remember when we were operating with the RAF used to give us Benzedrine tablets to keep us awake. But I'm afraid we didn't use them for the correct purpose.
What purpose did you use them for?
Well, I used to see if it worked when we were going ashore, just to add a little bit of zest to the proceedings. But I don't think they did. I don't think they were all that effective. But anyway, we never used them to keep us awake when we were flying.